This is tape two of Colonel Pete Peterson's oral interview of 8 May 2000. This is tape two of the Colonel Peterson tape and side 2A.
I appreciate Jenny Dalton anyway. Her contribution was cheerfulness, in my opinion, and that was valuable. If I don't know what she did, that was more my deficiency than trying to say she was useless or anything.
The British aircraft crash, we had to set up an air search helping them. Who found their aircraft, do you know?
No, I don't remember. It would have been Lasseter or Adams, probably. Mm-hmm. It could have been Darlington, but I just don't know.
Yeah, one of our planes did.
Yeah. I didn't participate in that. They were doing the airplanes. They didn't ask me to come along and do anything. Mm-hmm. And I was just hoping that they would find it and hoping that they could resurrect it and bring it back. Because the more airplanes, the better. Airplanes are very useful, and they're always very expensive. And the Marine Corps, I know that I've been quite active in the Marine Corps about aircraft, and they're terribly, terribly expensive. I remember once when I was Secretary of the Marine Corps Equipment Board, we were able to say we had the F-4 Phantom jet made in St. Louis, and I remember going to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and we gave a Marine Corps presentation, and at the end we wanted to be modest about it and said, now, if you want to fly the world's fastest operational aircraft, you can join the Marine Corps, and there's a colonel or something, whatever it is, down at the other end if you want to sign up. And that's all we said. And the Air Force was terribly embarrassed that they let us in to tell the Air Force people what the Marine Corps did as an instruction, sort of a classroom. And then a lot of them signed up with the Marine Corps. Because, you know, you can do that. You can graduate from an academy and pick your choice. Because they wanted to fly that fast aircraft.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful aircraft, F-4, yeah. At the time, it was marvelous.
Here you are.
I'm very enthusiastic about airplanes, but I respect them highly, mm-hmm. and I'll go out of the way to make sure there's an aircraft available in the Marine Corps or an expedition or whatever it is. But I just didn't get much involved with it, even though I had a pilot's license. I didn't particularly mm-hmm. want to bother with that thing. Yeah.
You're nearing the end of the summer.
Yep.
Was the plan to leave at the end of the summer?
Oh, yeah. At the proper time, we'll leave. Now, one of the things we did was to throw lampblack out on the snow and have the sun melt it to melt our way out. So we took a Weasel, which is a track vehicle.
This is on the sea ice, you mean?
Yeah, and we drove over the sea ice, which was strong enough, and we threw lampblack or carbon black on the ice, and then the sun would get warm, and it would drill or melt a pathway. That helped. There was some argument about could we ever have gotten out by ourselves, and it never occurred to me that we couldn't have gotten out. But then since there were these Navy icebreakers there, we were very happy to let them clear away from us and take advantage of that. I believe we would have had no trouble whatsoever. We didn't need them, but if they're there, we were wise to use them, as opposed to telling them to go home and wait a little longer and so forth, and then have a higher risk. But we were very happy to welcome the icebreakers there, you know, for contacts and so forth.
How did you leave the camp? Were the British still there?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And you left, did you board it up?
Yeah, we boarded it up and we expected them not to bother it. I don't know if it would be correct to say we gave them the key, but I assume we gave them a key.
Mm-hmm.
And we locked it up. Again, I married a South American, so I don't want to say anything against the South Americans, but I guess we felt that there may be visitors from miscellaneous South American countries, and if they visit for a day, they might make a mess. Whereas the British, we felt, were very disciplined about these things, and they had a base there, and they had had a strong desire to preserve that as an emergency for themselves and for anyone else that's trapped in that part of the world. So the British, I think, were very keen about preserving it. The visiting South Americans were less keen about preserving it. I don't want to show any prejudice here, but I believe that's what the situation was. And we locked it up. And I think if we had a key, we probably gave it to, I'm sure we would have given it to the British. I don't know that for a fact. But the idea would be we trusted them to preserve everything for whoever might need it. But they didn't particularly want to occupy it for, they had their own base, which is fine, and they didn't want to stretch out into another base.
Which icebreakers were those that were there?
Well, I think I'm afraid I've lost the memory in that. I think it was Edisto.
Edisto?
E-D-I-S-T-O, yeah.
Guess one.
If there was a second, I think there may have been, I'm afraid I don't know. Burton Island sounds very familiar. Whether that was there or whether that was off in the distance, I don't remember. The Edisto was one I could see, mm-hmm. and the Burton Island may have been over the horizon someplace. Talking by radio and so forth.
Okay. You finished the field work. Summer wound down. You all came back to the base, closed it up, and got on the ship and headed out.
Headed out, yeah. Also, we had an obligation to spend a year there, so we had to wait until the year was over.
Just to do a year.
Yeah, so. You might say a contractual obligation was that we would do a year's work down there.
Particularly the meteorology.
Yeah, meteorologist and anything else. And so we, I think we had some obligation to spend a year there. That may have been a factor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the ship left. Where did it make landfall when it left the Antarctic?
I would assume... it must have been only Punta Arenas, Chile, so Mrs. Darlington, who was pregnant, could get off and go to an Argentine hospital for delivery of a child. I believe she ended up getting on a good airplane, a fast airplane or something, or quickly getting on an airplane and delivering a child in the USA, but I don't know, I forget where she delivered her child. But she was pregnant. And
how pregnant was she? I mean, 8 months at the time?
As such that there was some urgency in getting her to a hospital. Which would be in Argentina, or the USA if there was time. I don't know where the baby was born, but so she got off the plane, off our ship at Punta Arenas, and took a local airplane up to Buenos Aires, and then I don't know where she delivered the child, either there or in the States, I don't know.
So you went to Ushuaia, Argentina?
We got to Punta Arenas, which is Chile.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and she got off there. Now, I believe that she didn't get on an icebreaker, but my memory is such, my knowledge is such that I forget how she left the group. But she did leave the group to deliver her child. And I believe that she got off and put to Arenas, but it's possible that she took an icebreaker out of it. The icebreaker would have gotten there quicker.
Okay.
I think it's unlikely that she went on an icebreaker, but I'm afraid I can't remember. Was she with us on that northbound trip? The northbound trip was not as bad as the southbound trip as far as weather goes. The sea was calmer.
Calm Drake.
Yeah.
The urgency was to get her back as soon as...
Well, to meet the year's requirement and then to get out at the first opportunity, because if we waited till the last opportunity, it might freeze over again. It would be locked more tightly in the ice if we waited too long. So we had to pick a good when the ice was sufficiently broken up by the lamp black and so forth, then we should go. First was the year, second was the lamp black, and the third was more or less of all equal importance, Mrs. Darlington.
Yes.
I never was that intimate with anyone as to how urgent, how pregnant she was, and I'm not sure they even knew for sure.
Jackie Ronnie didn't get pregnant down there?
No.
I see. The ship went, did you go back home all the way with the ship?
All the way to New York, yeah.
The ship went back to New York
to
City?
To New York City, yeah.
Doc, so it stopped there, and was it turned back over to the Navy, or?
I would assume so, yeah. We rented it, you might say, for a dollar or something. For the life of the expedition, And then we went to New York, I think, because some prestige or something, rather than getting off at some little port like Beaumont, Texas or something. So we went to New York and had a small celebration there, and then everyone was free to go. But we, I think Captain Ronnie said, I want nobody to leave the ship until he's written up what he's supposed to write up. So a lot of people, including myself, were stuck in the ship for a while until we finished writing up what we had to write up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he also trusted me to finish up later whatever I didn't finish at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the basic information, the most valuable stuff, and then I did some interpretation of it on the ship in New York.
Are you in contact with any of the other members today?
Not much, no. Mostly just Bob Dodson, yeah.
Just mostly Bob Dodson.
Yeah.
The doctor down in Monterey?
Oh, I see him too with my wife, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jackie?
Yeah. No, I've never seen Jackie again.
Never.
I've never seen Jackie after I returned, no. Never have.
Most pleasant.
Not that I can remember, and if I did see it, it would have been very short.
I
was not very close to Jackie. There was no mutual dislike, and there was no dislike on my part. It just,
she's the most charming person. Very nice.
I understand today. She's very charming, but I didn't achieve mutual charm with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any explanation for that.
Well, that's a different situation.
It didn't. The fact that I didn't get too intimate with her, it didn't bother me. I did get more intimate with Mrs. Darlington, perhaps because Mrs. Darlington was, although she was a married woman, she was more free in the hierarchy, whereas Jackie was tied to Finn in a hierarchical relationship. And I never was terribly close to Finn, although I think he knew that I supported him almost all the time, primarily because I respected his work as the champion of the expedition, as the guy who got things done, and a man who endured well ruthless criticism from many people who I thought were not qualified to criticize, and that there was a generation gap. Finn, of course, was somewhat older than us. He might have been fatherly age, and we might have been late, young, 20-year-old people. But I resented. First, I left my parents at an early age, and I had some squabbles or something, and I became financially independent, not wealthy, of course, but I managed to sneak to get by on my own at age 14 and up. And I had a work ethic or something like that to me. And I also realized that I have a major deficiency and that I was more like Forrest Gump or something, a guy who didn't have much self-ambition. He didn't push for getting promoted here and there. It just sort of came his way. I have never aggressively pushed for anything in my life. I worry about that. I could say I don't have any balls or something like that because I haven't pushed hard enough. But
made Colonel of Marine Corps.
Well, yes, and I was a combat officer in charge of troops, leading them into combat, and that I did, and
I think I did
it well. I was, in a sense, popular. They decided to give me a Silver Star or something.
Mm-hmm.
And my popularity may have been due to the fact that I always squared with the troops. As a physicist, I couldn't deceive them in any way, and I didn't believe in trickery. I believed in telling them what the situation is, what they had to do. I remember one case I was somewhat criticized for. I said, we're going to cross a river at about midnight, and we're going to attack at the first light of dawn and walk in between and climb up a mountain in between. And we're going to have a real good surprise, and that'll be very important. And we can't do anything wrong. Nothing can rattle on your body. And I want everyone to take the boots and stockings off and cross the river barefooted, and then put them back in again. I don't want everyone to have wet boots at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. I think that you'll feel bad. So take the boots off when we cross the river, and with the chance of getting caught in the river is almost negligible, so we can afford to do that. Some people thought that was sissy or something, but I think this is maybe a trivial thing I shouldn't have said. But in any case, then when we got to the other side, we saddled up, as it were, and we did a very good job of taking the top of the hill. Sintan Ni, it's called, and overlooking the Watchon Reservoir and so forth. And it was a crucial thing, and the division and the regiment and so forth had expected that to be taken, and we got to the top okay. And that was the job well done, you might say. But I was very meticulous about a lot of little details in order to put the chances in our favor.
So were you in, I think this brings up a good point. Were you in the Marines when you went with Finrani? Were you seconded?
No. I've only been a reservist. I went up in World War II, and I went, and they called me up in the Korean War, and I didn't resist it. You know, mm-hmm. I could have maybe made some argument about resisting it, but it never occurred to me to resist it. And then I served a third time, and then I want to say I enjoyed the Marine Corps particularly. I learned a lot from it. It was a very valuable experience, and I was able to, I think, make a good contribution wherever I was. And
but you stayed in the reserves.
I always stayed in the reserve. Yeah, I never became a regiment.
When did you retire from the reserve?
Well, I retired from the reserve, I guess, age 60 or something like that, whatever the maximum age was. And I was in charge of a volunteer unit here in San Francisco, the commanding officer of that. And that was, I guess, very popular. And I felt I had a good career. Now, of course, I came out of it whole. I wasn't injured, didn't lose a limb or anything like that. And they spent a lot of money training me. They paid me to go to college for a while. And after the war was over, the GI Bill was very important for me. And then I was given promotion from time to time, and I dealt at one time with a Marine Corps group that explained the Marine Corps mission to legislative committees in order to get funding. So I was at a very high level in that sense.
When did you first join the Marines?
Very shortly after Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm. How old were you?
17, I guess, with minimum age, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you were enlisted at first?
I was enlisted, yeah.
Throughout World War II?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
when did you get your commission?
Pardon?
When did you get your commission?
Oh, within World War II.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I got it within World War II.
Commission?
Yeah.
Where did you
Did you say battlefield commission? No,
yes.
I got a academic commission or something.
I see.
Now, I didn't have a college degree at the time, but today, I guess you don't get commissions until you get a college degree, but I got a commission based on some college and so forth.
I see.
And I got a good commission in the Marine Corps.
I see. And so you ended the war with first lieutenant?
As a second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant?
Yeah, the war was over. I got out of the war. I was trained to land at Chickasaki Beach mm-hmm. in the Kanto Plain south of Tokyo.
And
it would have been, of course, a very difficult. The beach was quite good. From a Marine Corps standpoint, the Chickasaki Beach on the Kanto Plain south of Tokyo was a perfect place to land. But it would have been, if you attacked the Japanese on their homeland, it was expected that they would have fought very hard, harder than giving up an island or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been tough. But then they dropped the atomic bomb, and that was the end of that. And they were told, okay, the bomb's over, it looks like we're going to have peace, so we're probably not going to land at Chickasaki Beach. So the atomic bomb, in that sense, saved my life. It also saved a lot of Japanese lives. I mean, they lost a couple hundred thousand, perhaps due to the bomb, but it would have been millions if there was a landing there.
Did you see combat anywhere else in World War II?
No, I didn't see combat mm-hmm. until
the
Korean War, and I saw a lot of combat.
How long were you in Korea?
I forget, but I guess about 2.5 years.
Up in the north?
Yep. I had a mentor, General Thomas, and he was a great guy. He said the turtle gets ahead by sticking his neck out. And so I was a bit of an iconoclast from time to time. But I told him I wanted to get combat, so he said, okay, here's the order. So they sent me out as an infantry officer replacement. And then he's been my mentor ever since. And he got me all the jobs I ever had in the Marine Corps. I was very lucky about that. He seemed to mm-hmm. like me and worked out fine.
No chesty puller?
Oh, I certainly did, yeah. No, I never served under him, but I certainly know him, yeah. Mm-hmm. Talked to him, and I respect him. And I suppose you could say, I don't want to make a comparison between, I don't want to make a general comparison between Fin Ronny and Trustee Puller, but Trustee Puller had a lot of things that you could complain about, and as you could MacArthur and Patton and a lot of other people, but he was a Marine Corps ideal, and he was very heroic, and he was very competent. He had a loud mouth, but he was very competent, and he never exaggerated anything. I mean, he spoke the truth, you might say. I respected him.
What you saw? Did you? Were you in Vietnam? I guess is a question. No.
No.
Anyway, you went into civilian life after the Ronny expedition.
Yes.
Yeah. You went back to university, you say?
I went to Harvard Business School, yeah.
Returned to Harvard Business School in, well, that was about
1948 or 49, yeah.
And how long were you there?
Well, I graduated in 1950.
Mm-hmm. And you became investment banker?
Yes.
Right afterwards, or
yep.
Worked your way into it?
Well, not exactly. After I had gotten out of the, I'm slightly confused on the sequence here, but after I got out of the Harvard Business School, I went to work for General Electric in the Systems and Methods Group, which probably would have been a predecessor to computerization. Let me put it this way. Before I went on the Antarctic expedition, I worked for United Airlines. And I took my knowledge of dial telephony, and we made, before the computer was invented, and we set up a pseudo computer system for reservations for United Airlines between Boston, Cleveland, Chicago, and then back triangularly to New York. And I was working in the United Airlines engineering department in the home office in Chicago, and we had a very good system for making reservations, which was very important for filling the seats and so forth, because previously we had to assume how many people would go and how many would return and so forth, and we ended up with a lot of empty seats. So then that same knowledge I was able to use in General Electric, and then I was called up from General Electric for the Korean War, and I left General Electric, went to the Korean War. Then when I came back, I went directly into investment banking with Kidder Peabody, 17 Wall Street, and I was in the underwriting department, a corporate finance department. And I worked for a guy called the Silver Fox. He had silver hair, very foxy, and a man whom I respected very highly, Lewis Miltimore. And that was a good experience for me. Then I was financing a company, Ultra Chemical, in New Jersey. And I guess I did a good job on that, and J. Peter Grace acquired the company, probably based on my analysis of it, and then he asked me if I would come and work for him. And I didn't like him particularly, but I liked Andrew Shea, who was the highest paid man in the company, Andrew B. Shea hired me. He was the president of Panagra Airline, the president of the Grace Bank, the president of a whole lot of other things. And Grace was a company that was founded in Peru. It's not basically an American company. It's a Peruvian company.
This is the
W.R. Grace. It's a billion-dollar company that was founded in Peru. Mm-hmm. And as they grew, they went to the States. But I was then hired as director of industrial development based in Lima, Peru, for the entire enterprise. And I enjoyed that very much. Mm-hmm. And I got to like Peru, although initially I was disappointed with the country, but I got to like it very much.
Your wife is from Peru?
Yep. And I have you a house. We have a house down there, and the kids went to school there and so forth.
No, you still go back?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. We still maintain the house, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think of Peru today with Fujimori and company?
That's probably an important question. It deals with Fin Ronny, it deals with MacArthur, it deals with Patton. Fujimori has made a lot of mistakes. He's arrogant and all that stuff, but he accomplished things that I think other people couldn't have done. Namely, he stopped the Fujimori and so forth, and I did make a connection between that and Finn Ronnie, of course, totally different people, but and some others, but he did a lot of, he took a lot of shortcuts, and as I was told in the Marine Corps, the turtle gets ahead by sticking its neck, his neck out, so Fujimori stuck his neck out on many things, but he rescued the country from a terrible insurrection, and I think he's doing a fair job on the economic side. I think the new contender is probably better trained as an economist. He's formally trained as an economist in school, and that will be helpful and needed. And that's all right. Fujimori has cleaned things up, and now another guy can come in, and he's a native. He claims he's a native Indian and has a lot of nativeness about him, and Indian native type thing, and he's winning some votes from that standpoint, ethnic standpoint, you might say, but that he's also a very accomplished, well-trained economist, and that, I think, is a desirable thing for the country at this stage. The insurrection having been suppressed, and there's a fair amount of democracy in the country, he will now enhance the democracy, which Fujimori didn't feel he could do because of his need for power to accomplish things.
Is the standard of living going up?
Well, I don't know what it is statistically, but I would say what's happening in Peru is that poverty-stricken Indians who find subsistence living very difficult are moving into the cities. And if you look at from a city standpoint, they're swamped with untrained Indians, and it's creating a lot of trouble. And they live in a mess, in a hovels and so forth. So in that sense, it would look like it's coming down. But I think living in a hovel in the city is probably better for them than living on subsistence farming in very difficult land, for which they don't have the technology and the capital to work properly. The subsistence living in the third world has nothing to modernize it, to make it work properly. I think it could work better with some technology and some management and better capital and so forth, access to capital. I'm very much involved with that. I've worked, I'll send you a who's who and you can look that over. I've lived in every continent for at least a year, and I've been in Africa, Kenya, which is a very nice country, and I've been in Asia, half a dozen countries there, and Europe and South America, and I've done a lot of work on setting investment banking up in third world countries, which I think is very important. Investment banking is nothing more than getting some private capital from people, little people, small amounts of money, lots of them, or large amounts of money from a few people, and applying it to development projects. And I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that very much. Right now, I'm involved primarily with working for a U.S. company in Boston, Massachusetts, and helping them develop their corporation, which means making mergers and acquisitions and backing high technology. And I've gone into such things which would be very exotic, such as stochastic resonance. Stochastic resonance.
I've heard of stochastic, but I don't remember what it was.
And nobody have any idea what it is. But it's basically signal-to-noise ratio enhancement.
Right.
Now, that could be very valuable. It could be very valuable for neurological systems in the body and for all kinds of communication and signaling and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of the company?
Well, I guess I better not mention that on the phone here, on the system. But it's listed. It's half of the corporation is owned by a family. The other half is listed on the American Stock Exchange. It's been in business for 50 years. They've been profitable practically all the time, and they're listed as one of the best small businesses in the U.S. And they have acquired companies. I've been instrumental in doing that, and then they have gone into some high technology now and then. And it's a company that's growing pretty nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a .com company. although I don't want to say there's anything wrong with that. I mean, .com is okay, but it's
I'm real careful about investing.
you have to be careful about investing there, yeah. And my role there is to find new technologies for them to invest in profitably. They're definitely a for-profit company. And to find acquisitions, and I could tell you a lot more about what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm innovative. I think I have a great skill in talking with people who don't want to be talked to, such as, dear Mr. So-and-so, would you please sell your company to my employer? Go to hell. Well, then I work on that. And and the last time the guy hung up and everything else, and they wrote him a very nice letter, and then he was completely turned over. And then I'm now dealing with the chairman. He was a former chairman. I'm now dealing with the current chairman, and invited to talk acquisition.
Yeah.
So,
what I'm going to ask you a final question about the Antarctic here.
Yep.
Would you do it all over again?
At this age, probably.
No, I mean, well, looking back, was it worthwhile?
Oh, there's no question about it. I'm glad I did it. It was a wonderful experience. It was an experience in an innovative project. Not terribly, well, some high technology, but not distinguished for that. It was distinguished for high innovation, high risk, and I enjoy that very much. And we all worked hard and we accomplished something. I was surprised at the bitching, because I'm not accustomed to bitching.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Marine Corps took that out of me, but I think I had acquired a habit of not bitching about things, taking what I have and doing the best I can for it, and that was a very important trait. It did serve me well in the Marine Corps. I learned from everybody, crotchety, fussy old bosses, officers, sergeants, drill sergeants, generals, whatever it is. Some are wonderful, easy people, and I'm very hard people, but I never bitched, and that was very important. It made life easy for me in the Antarctic. It made life very easy for me in the expedition, some risk and so forth, but psychologically and spiritually and loyalty, very easy. I consider myself very loyal to Finn. I respected what he did. I think some of the things he did could be criticized. I understood that. But overall, as a leader, as a champion of a project, he played a very important role. And that had taught me now to deal with entrepreneurs who are far from perfect, but are championing something. And I'm very much involved with a man who's championing a cure for cancer. And he's a crazy guy. College degree and all that, but makes a lot of mistakes. But he is putting resources together based on technology done by somebody else. He's making it into mm-hmm. a business. And clinical trials, which cost $100 million, he's getting that done. And it's very hard to do those things.
Ronnie was a get-it-done guy.
Yeah, that's right, and that's fine with me. I like that kind of guy. That was easy. Made it easy for me to work well. I think I have no enemies on the expedition. And some guys may regard me as placid or something, and not talkative too much, but I supported him, and I would support his wife, although there wasn't an occasion to do that. She didn't need much support. The management of an expedition like that, you see it in the military all the time. Who's in charge of a single ship, which can be quite isolated? Who's in charge of a platoon or a company that's off on a corner somewhere, and with difficult times, or Wake Island or Midway or something like that. The guy in charge of that, he's going to do things that can be criticized, but his nose is to the mission, and he accomplishes the mission.
In a way, it's a lot tougher than the military because there's no formal chain of command.
That's right, yeah.
But I assume mandatory loyalty, so to speak.
But with my background, I gave him mandatory command, and the others did not, and that's what that bothered me. Now, in civilian life, I've been in charge of a few things. I've been, an officer, a chairman, and so forth of different companies, and I know that it's tough to get universal support, But you have a mission to accomplish. And I suppose I would probably say that the guy who ran Sunbeam very badly, but was charming to Wall Street because he fired people so easily, that's too ruthless. That's too bad. I couldn't support that at all. A guy like Gerstner of IBM, who lets a few people off and who screwed up on the pension funds for older and younger people now, I think he's still doing a good job. But he's got caught in a trap which he wasn't smart enough to, not to avoid, but to handle properly. He didn't handle the pensions properly. The issue here is loyalty down. And if a leader doesn't have loyalty down, I guess I would say I don't support him. But if he has a good measure of loyalty down and a certain measure of loyalty up, he gets my support. The leadership issue is an important one. And I was disappointed that so many people, some of the people on the expedition, didn't appreciate that. They were bitching about him.
How was Vice like Schlossbach?
Ike Schlossbach, yeah, I came from New Jersey. I would say he supported Finn. And
he was a good military officer.
But he didn't assume a second in charge role. He was a bit reticent about asserting authority.
But he was second in charge, right?
Pardon?
He was to be second in charge, was he not, intentionally?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to say, I don't know. I respected him as a man that had wisdom and was fair-minded, more so perhaps than Finn, would not get dogmatic, was very concerned about how people would feel about things, and I respected him as a good officer, and also he seemed to know polar conditions quite well. I respected his knowledge, I respected his soundness of judgment. Those were almost sufficient in themselves. His knowledge, his intellect, his soundness of judgment, his fairness, that gave me high respect for him. I was somewhat disappointed that he didn't fulfill a role of what amounts in the military to executive officer. Or in civilian life, you have a chief executive officer and a chief operating officer or something. Second, and both fulfill separate important roles, and Finn didn't have that. Now maybe
you
Ike,
mean Ike? Ike
didn't. Finn didn't have
Finn,
that in
Finn
Ike,
did, yeah.
And Ike didn't display it. I think that in any operation, you need a decision maker, an ultimate decision maker. Sometimes he makes decisions which may be unpopular. They can't be popular all the time for everybody, and then you need an executive officer or someone else who will keep the show running. You certainly need a first sergeant. And then you also need in civilian life a planning officer. I think that's a very important role, someone in charge of planning. That could be the chairman. He doesn't do the detail work, but he does the vision for planning. And
you mean like a chairman of a board?
Yes, a good chairman really should be a planning officer. He has a vision for the future and what to do, where to put money at risk. And he takes responsibility, okay, we'll invest in that and it better damn well come out, but I'm not going to manage it in detail. Some other people will try to achieve it, but I hope to inspire them with a vision. And having done that, they'll do the rest of it themselves.
So Ike actually created an extra burden for Finn because he wasn't a good backup.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, yeah. Yep.
It's interesting.
Finn didn't have a number two.
You brought these aspects out about the Ronnie expedition.
Well, you hit the nail on the jackpot that Ike would appear to be, I guess from a resume or something, a highly competent guy, and I liked him very much, for example, and I think other people did, but he didn't give Finn the number two backup. He didn't. There was not treachery. It was passiveness.
Ike was anyone you speak of, speak to who served with Ike in the Antarctic, 33 and 39, a very charming man. I think a lot of him as a friend. And popular, obviously popular.
You could say easy to get along with, yeah.
Popular to the point where people would look to him rather than to Finn. That's a guess. I'm asking that question because I've seen it in other organizations.
Yes, they would. And then he either wouldn't say, frankly, I would prefer to go to the left, and if Finn wants to go to the right, we should do what the leader wants, even though I think going to the left is better, up or down, or left or right, or blue or green or something. That's one approach it could be. The other would be, I'm going to talk with Finn and try to convince him to do something else. Another approach would have been, I'm going to advise Finn on these things. Another thing would be, once Finn's made a decision, I'll back it fully. I won't compromise my integrity and my intelligence, my wisdom, but I'll back that perhaps on the basis of a decision has been made for the sake of coherence of the enterprise, mission fulfillment. We must do that decision until it's been proven wrong or until it's obvious that we have to change it. He didn't do that, and I wish he had done that. Now, of course, I've matured a lot since the expedition.
I understand, but this retrospect, this is what we're talking about now. Retrospect is probably is important.
Now, let me say a little bit bragging or something. In life, I recently went to Saudi Arabia. I'm one of the very few Americans who have gone to the Saudi Arabian oil company and given them serious, heartfelt, in-depth advice on what the strategy should be. You can record it, but don't publicize it. I, for example, have said you should take whatever surplus oil you have and burn it up and make electricity and make aluminum and other materials, chlorine, that take a lot of electricity and export that. You should do that as an added source of wealth. And most important of all, to stimulate the spirit of the enterprise. The enterprise is a little bit lethargic. The Americans found the oil there and did a heroic job, inspired job, of convincing the king to let those infidels or foreigners or strangers come in and get the oil out and give the king some money for that and make some money for themselves. And the king said, okay, come in here and we'll let you put up a compound and you can do any damn thing you want to do there. But don't go outside the compound and get drunk or anything like that. And the Americans, Standard Oil Company of California, right here down the street, mm-hmm. just a
I
couple of houses,
well.
They went over there and did the job. Then after that, they become big and almost necessarily regimented, but to me, spiritually lethargic, even though they're quite good technically. They're very good technically. And I said, if something goes wrong, there's a marvelous spirit of solving the problem. If there's an accident, it's solved beautifully. Beautifully is the word for it. It's solved.
The Saudis.
The Saudis with Americans, because the two work very well together, mainly because the requirements are that a Saudi must learn English. Americans don't have to learn Arabic. And so there's no problem with the language. Every Saudi I ever saw there speaks, was educated in the U.S. or an English-speaking country, London, United Kingdom, or New Zealand, or Australia. And so the language is not a problem. But the spirit of overcoming an obstacle, once the obstacle besets them, is marvelous. But they're not looking for new things. And I said, you've got to get a spirit of entrepreneurial sovereignty, meaning that you can do some things by yourself that are new and different. One of the things you can do is to burn up some oil because you have a tremendous surplus of oil and at a cheap rate, much cheaper than what you'd sell it for. And that can be done okay with the World Trade Organization. It has to be done in a certain way, but it can be done okay. And then make aluminum cheap and so forth and get into those markets in addition to oil and energy, even though oil and energy are the biggest one. You should do that.
You're making aluminum in Dubai. I mean, an ingot in Dubai.
They're making what?
Ingot, aluminum.
Oh, yeah. Some of the places that are beginning to realize that if the oil is cheap, you can make electricity cheap, and cheap electricity is the heart and soul of aluminum and chlorine and other things. And then I also said you should have an electronic marketplace for the crude oil exports, and maybe you should bring OPEC into that. And then you should also have, this is a much bigger term, financial hegemony. In other words, Saudis are not too good on doing nitty-gritty work, and they hate like hell mopping a floor or something like that. They don't want to do that. That's okay. But they're pretty good in handling money, even. There might be some apparent exceptions to that, but they're quite good at handling money, and they're very good at making sound investments. And, of course, they also waste a lot of money on luxury, but I'm forgetting that. And I said, well, the money that you have, it's about $100 million every 10 hours. $100 million every 10 hours. You should invest, you should learn to do investment banking and deal making as opposed to brokerage. And you should be on top of the strategy of businesses in the world. That's something you could aim at. And you have some very capable people in that area. You could do that. You don't need to be in Wall Street to do that. And so they invited me and my wife, first class, to come over there and put me up in a luxury home with lots of servants and so forth to advise them on that. Now, then I've also talked with the chairman, not the present one, but a previous one of IBM, and used my methods of getting through to him, and I was invited for a breakfast meeting, and then I got him to agree to sell his biomedical systems division, which was on the front page of his annual report for that year, but he agreed to sell it, primarily because of the spiritual side that it would be more successful if it wasn't a subordinate